It went straight down the middle. Then it started.
Well, welcome to another edition of For the Good of the Game. And Bruce Devlin, our guest today, first of all, is one of the youngest guests we've had. And secondly, he may be at least the second former member of the armed forces we've ever had. So we're going to talk to him about that as well.
Yeah, no, well, he's got a further record than that, though. He was recognized by his peers as one of the greatest strikers of the golf ball that ever played the game. Case in point, 48 victories around the world. And I got to tell you, it's a great pleasure to have Nick Price with us today. And Nicky, welcome aboard, pal.
Thanks, Bruce. Thanks, Mike. Good to be with you guys.
Yeah, great to have you. And as always, Nick, as we try to tell your story, we generally start at the beginning. And I think with you growing up where you did, there was some interesting history from your country of nationality, I guess, Rhodesia, Zimbabwe. Maybe start just with your early memories of growing up in that part of the world.
Well, you know, I was actually born in South Africa. My parents had emigrated to South Africa. They had met in India during the Second World War. My mom served in the Indian Army as a theater sister, and my dad was a major in the artillery. And then in 1947, when Pakistan got its independence from India, they left and were on their way to the Sudan, and they had an uprising in the Sudan. So they stayed on the ship and got off at Durban, and my middle brother, or as I called him, was born there. My eldest brother was born in Karachi, and then my middle brother was born in Durban, as I was. And then we moved up to Rhodesia in 1962, just before my fifth birthday. So I don't really remember too much about South Africa, but you know, growing up in Zimbabwe was a very simple life. I guess you could sort of compare it to a small Midwestern town here in the U.S. where, you know, the schools had, we had great schools. We had fantastic weather. We 5,000 feet above sea level. It never got very hot. And when I say never got very hot, up on the plateau where we were, you know, a really hot day was in the sort of like the low 90s. And then in wintertime, we'd get a little bit of frost at night or, you know, in the morning. But it would warm up, you know, during the day to sort of high 60s to 70s. So it was very temperate climate, and it was conducive for outdoor sport, which is what we were all hooked on. I mean, I had two older brothers who, and my dad was a huge cricket fanatic. And so all of my brothers and I, you know, we started playing cricket and, you know, putting comic magazines in our long socks as pads when we were like 4 or 5 years old. You know, we were playing cricket with a tennis ball in the garden because we'd broken so many windows. But anyway, you know, we grew up playing so many sports, and I started off, you know, junior school playing soccer, cricket, played a little bit of field hockey. And then, you know, like everyone else, we swam in summer, did a lot of swimming and athletics. And then when we got to high school, we were allowed to play rugby. I started playing rugby then. So I was really lucky. I got a really good grounding in all sorts of sports. When I started playing golf, I just gravitated toward the game. But it was a very simple upbringing. My family didn't have much money, but in those days, it didn't cost a lot of money to play golf. In fact, the club that I ended up joining as a junior member, it cost $1 a year, and we had 10 cents green fees for 18 holes. So it was relatively cheap, and we all carried our own bags, or we had, you know, some guys had golf trolleys or golf carts, you know, that you would drag behind. Yeah. But it was great fun. It was a wonderful place to grow up. A lot of discipline in the schools, which was great. You know, we could get into trouble for what looks like when you look back on menial things and that, but it was a great grounding for us.
Do you remember much? And then I'll get off the politics, but just Rhodesia, independence in 1965. Then they went through a period through 1980 before they became Zimbabwe. What are your memories of that? Because you must have entered the military sometime toward the tail end of that, I suppose.
Huh? Yeah, 76, 77, I did my military. I started in, I think it was March of 76, and finished in October of 77. And originally, it was national service. You had to do it.
Right.
And my eldest brother did 6 months. He was 11 years older than I was. My other brother, who was 7 years older than I was, he did 9 months. And when I got in, it was a year. And we were halfway through basic training, which most people who've been through that will tell you it's not much fun. And they lopped on another 6 months. So there were 92 of us in my intake. Well, sorry, 102 of us in the intake. And you've never seen 102 more glum faces after they announced we had an extra 180 days thrown in. But, you know, we had a war going on there. That was it was terrible. It was a communist-inspired war. I mean, look, we can talk about the politics of it as ad infinitum, but, you know, we didn't have apartheid written into our constitution in Zimbabwe. We were in Rhodesia at the time. And, you know, it just, we never really felt like there was racism in our country. I mean, there were pockets of it, but, you know, my mom and dad taught us respect and to respect everyone. Right. And we did. So, you know, I think we had a wonderful racial harmony in our country, certainly when I was growing up. And then, you know, like I say, there was a war that started back right after independence. You know, you can sort of look back and question how it started and that, because it was on the heels of us unilaterally declaring independence from Britain, which the US did, just so happens about 150 or 200 years earlier.
Yeah,
but we were, for some reason, we were picked on, which was kind of sad.
What's the big deal, right? Everybody does it.
Yeah. Anyway.
Even the Aussies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we didn't fancy being, you know, told what to do from 4,500 miles away. No. So,
well, at your induction examination, entering the Rhodesian Air Force, you are purported to have made some comment about a skin problem. Do you remember that?
That was a buddy of mine. That was a buddy of mine when we were. Well, it wasn't really. He became a friend of mine, but when he going through the. Training, the basic training, you had to have a medical, and, you know, your first day you're there, you have a haircut and whatever. And the guy in front of us went to the medical officer and said, the medical officer said to him, you know, have you got any reason why you shouldn't go in? And this is when a conscientious objector would sort of say, yes, I'm a conscientious. And so he said, I've got this problem, skin. And, of course, there was a deathly silence behind us. And the guy said, what's wrong with your skin? He says, bullets go through it. He said, get in here. Yeah.
Get in here.
Get in here.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to just your introduction to the game of golf. I guess at age 5, that would have put you either just still in Durban or just having moved to Rhodesia,
yeah.
Right?
I had, as I said, I had two older brothers, and my middle brother, Tim, who actually was a wonderful sportsman, a jack of all trades. He could play every sport. He was 7 years old, and I was about 8 years old when he asked me with three of his friends. They were going off to sneak onto this golf course, and they said, don't you want to come with us? And I thought, well, this is the first time these guys ever invited me to do anything, you know, because normally they would leave me behind, you know, so. Eventually, I realized when we snuck onto this golf course that I was the caddy. I was the designated caddy.
Okay.
So, and I remember they had bought a set of clubs in this old canvas bag from a secondhand shop that must have had, I don't know, 30, maybe 32 clubs in it. And there was an assortment there. There was two left-handed clubs. There was hickory shafted drivers. There was, I mean, plastic coated wedges. I mean, just a real oleo hodgepodge of clubs. And so I was left-handed at the time. I batted in cricket left-handed and played every two-handed sport left-handed. But this bag had the strap had worn, and there was a piece of rope that was the strap. So you can only imagine the weight of this thing. And so I'm putting this thing on my shoulder because the boys had showed me how to do it. And, you know, I'm walking, this thing's cutting into my shoulder so bad. Eventually, I started dragging it down the middle of the fairway. So, and then, of course, these guys, the four of them, were there were two left or three left and one right.
You're
and,
all over the place.
They were all over the place, you know, and losing balls left, right, and center. But
they should have paid you by the mile.
Yeah, they didn't pay me at all, you know, but that didn't surprise me in those days. I was just happy to go along. But, you know, the first time I got on this golf course, which wasn't one of the really good courses at home. It was a daily fee sort of golf course that you would have here. But I got on these fairways and then these greens. I had never seen, you know, grass that beautiful in my life. And so I remember that, you know, if you ask me what my greatest memory of that first day was how beautiful the greens were and how manicured. Because we'd never seen anything like that. I guess, you know, it's like Australia, Bruce. You know, get away from the ocean and the grass is as rough as a goat's knee, you know.
Or you could have started like I did up in Yass, a little town outside of where I lived. And we, you know, sand greens, you know, forget the grass. Mm. We had smooth sand to put on.
Yeah, with oil mixed in, yeah.
Correct.
Exactly, yeah.
So it wouldn't blow away.
Yeah.
Funny.
So, yeah, we snuck onto this golf course, and I'll just go back quickly, just tell you how it started. But we snuck onto this golf course a couple of times, and we eventually got caught by one of the members there, you know, and he was really nice. He said, listen, you guys don't need to be sneaking on the golf course here. You can go up to the golf, you can join this club, and they have a junior golf program and all this where province I grew up in was Mashonaland, and the Mashonaland Golfers Junior Golf Association had during our holidays would have Monday to Friday, they'd have a little junior tournament every morning. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and it was at a different course every day, which was great, you know. So we could get out there and play, and it used to cost us, I think in those days it was like 20 cents to play. So our moms would drop us off at the golf course, and we'd spend pretty much the whole day there, or the other mom would pick us up. But it was a wonderful way to spend your holidays. You know, I mean, we're all sport mad. And of course there wasn't a lot of sport in the holidays, cricket or rugby and that, because we'd have the break, you know, from school. But, the golf was a great, escape for me, you know. It was, and I had a wonderful group of friends. That was probably what did it. You know, I had like five or six really good buddies who we used to play regularly in all of these events. And of course the competitiveness amongst us was unbelievable, because we were all competitive at sport. So that's basically how I got started. And I switched over from left-handed because I couldn't find left-handed clubs, to right-handed, probably when I was about 9, 10. So I played for quite a while left-handed, but you know, we couldn't get left-handed clubs in those days. You probably remember, yeah, Bruce, in the '60s. You know, the left-handed clubs were hard to come by.
Yeah, and interestingly too, Nick, I don't know if you know this, but David Graham originally was a left-hander.
Oh, I didn't know. Yeah,
yeah, and the guy that he worked for at the club that he was with in Melbourne, he said to him one day, you know, David, you need to turn around and play right-handed, and you know, just like you. Mm. I mean, yeah, two left-handers turned into major champion right-handers. That's pretty fancy.
Yeah. We talked to Curtis Strange recently too, and he shoots a gun left-handed. He shoots pool left-handed. He does a lot of things left-handed, but he ended up playing golf right-handed, and we asked him if he could play on both sides, and he said, no.
No.
Yeah.
And, you know, Nick, there's one other thing too, talking about Curtis Strange. When we had him on, he was relating the same sort of story you did about playing all the different sports, and he felt like that was a very important thing for him.
Right.
That, you know, he learned how to play all the different sports, and his hand-eye coordination became very good. And, of course, that's what you need to play golf.
Oh, for sure. I think just, you know, any ball game that you play, whether it's tennis or squash or cricket, you know, where you have an implement, whether it's a squash racket, a tennis racket, a cricket bat or a golf club, that gives you such, you know, that gives you a great grounding for golf. You start understanding about spin, what gets the ball to spin, obviously playing cricket, you know, and that sort of thing. So, and I think that all, you know, you, when you start playing golf, you're trying to hit all the shots, you know, you read all the magazines and you watch some of the better players at the club and you just, you know, you try and emulate what they're doing. So you learn very quickly as a youngster. We didn't have, obviously, the media that is available to the youngsters today, which I think is, you know, accelerates their progress because they can split their swing, put their swing up on a split screen next to a Tigers or next to a John Rahm or next to a Rory McIlroy. And, you know, I think that because kids are great mimics. And if I'd had the opportunity to do that when I was a kid, I think, you know, I would have probably had, in the early days, a much better swing than the one I started with.
Yeah, but you ended up with a great one, pal. I got to tell you that. Man, what a swing.
Well, who were some of your key mentors, Nick, in helping you develop your game at a young age?
Well, my brother, for sure. You know, Tim was, as I say, he started playing, what was he? He was about 15, and by the time he was 17, he was a scratch player. So he progressed very quickly. And he loved the game as well. So I learned a lot from him. In fact, you know, we were going probably through a learning curve together at that stage. Mine was, I couldn't quite absorb as much as he did, but he taught me so much about the game. And then, you know, watching a lot of the players around, I guess when I was, before I was 15, 14, 15, I watched a lot of the good players. We didn't have much teaching there. In fact, I only ever really had one lesson when I was about 17. I had the shanks, and I went to the local pro there to give me a lesson, and he kind of helped me a bit. But, you know, the next lesson I had was with Ledbetter in like 1982. So very self-taught, and all of us were down there. You know, Dennis Watson was a compatriot of mine. So was Mark McNulty, Tony Johnson, who now commentates for Sky, but also, you know, very successful in Europe, won the British PGA. But we, you know, we had some really, really good players come out of our country, and it, we should have, because the conditions, the weather, the inexpensive or the low cost of playing golf was there. So it didn't matter what background you came from, you could play. So it was great fun. And, you know, we had our nose buried in golf magazines and golf books. And when, you know, every drawer in my house or desk had a golf book or magazine on it. And of course, you know, you try these things. Unfortunately, that's the hard thing about reading and learning the game from a golf magazine or book or pictures is that they're static. You don't actually see right. The movement. So that's, you know, why I think, you know, my swing was a little bit short and fast, but I only really got to see a lot of golf because we didn't have any golf on TV in those days. But the only golf we got to watch was the cigarette companies, which obviously we grew a lot of tobacco in our country. They would bring these promotional films from, you know, the Masters, from the British Open, from Piccadilly World Match Play, which was a big event in those days. And they'd have two screenings of it at our club. And that was the only time we ever saw, you know, motion in golf swings, other than the guys that were at the club, the good players. So my sort of mentoring, to answer your question in a long way, but my mentoring sort of came from, I guess, my watching the great players, the good players at our club, and the good amateurs at home, and then obviously my brother.
Yeah.
That's an interesting observation that a lot of what you saw and were exposed to was static, meaning golf magazines. That's kind of like the way I learned as a kid. We didn't have a pro. It was just a little 9-hole course with no bunkers. And so you just pulled out all the golf magazines, and I clipped all the articles out, you know, the one-page lessons on this and that. But it was all static, although in the U.S. we did have the opportunity to see a little bit more on television back then, so you could maybe go a little bit beyond just that picture.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about junior career then, because you had some success. You played on the school golf team. So was that a high school sort of team at Prince Edward?
Yeah, we didn't really have golf in school until the last year I was there. The headmaster we had at the time didn't like individual sport, but because we'd had so much success as in the national team, the Rhodesia Junior national team, we'd beaten South Africa, who had an extremely strong team. But we beat them back in, I think it was 73. So my last year at school, one of the teachers had started the golf team. So, but it didn't really catch on at that stage. So most of our golf was played outside of school time. You know, we'd play on the weekends when we'd have some of the provincial amateurs or the, you know, the interprovincial, which was great fun. And at that stage, you know, not only was I playing junior golf, but I also got into, you know, the provincial team on a senior level, or, you know, the amateur level, which was great. So I was keeping busy.
So your trip to San Diego for the Junior World Championships at age 17, was that your first big trip outside of the country?
Yeah, it was. My buddy Fred Beaver had come back the year before, and there was no way, I mean, we could ever afford a trip to go to California. But he had told me that, you know, they gave money, the Junior World people gave money to each country to go. And so that paid for my air ticket, which was terrific. And, you know, we were billeted out with people, and I stayed with a guy called Doug Clark, who was a very, very good player at the time in 74. But an interesting thing happened that about 6 months before I left, or 7 months before I left, we were playing the small ball. And Bruce, you grew up playing the small ball. Absolutely. As I did. And all the amateur tournaments were with the small ball. And I switched to the big ball because I knew I was going to go and play in America. And I thought, you know, it was right at the time when the British Open had just changed to the big ball. I think 74 was the first one. I think Gary Player won with Weisskopf was the last to win with a small ball in 73, and then Player won in 74 with a big ball. And so I started playing with the big ball. And of course, there was a handicap in those days, especially, you know, the amateur tournament. So my amateur performance for a while sort of went backwards. But when I got over to San Diego, I had no transition going to the big ball. So it was great. And that, you know, that was like a dream come true for me to win there. I didn't know how good I was. And my mom thought this would be a great trip because if I did think I was good, it was going to get knocked out of me while I was over there.
Sure, yeah.
So, but then I ended up winning, you know, and then obviously they got the full support of my family after that. But it was a trip of a lifetime for me. And then I went back again. Actually, Gary Player had a junior tournament in South Africa that I was invited to. And here I'd never traveled more than maybe 1,800 miles from my home. And I go to America twice in 1 year played at the Orange Bowl in Miami and met David Abel, who he and I became great friends. But at that stage, there were a couple of guys, youngsters that I was there who were playing in the Orange Bowl who were really good 17-year-olds. And David Abel had just got there and he'd just got into the 15 to 17 division. And I played with him, and he beat us all by 9 shots.
Oh my.
And I thought, well, you know, maybe San Diego was a bit of a fluke, you know. But so anyway, it was a great experience for me to do 2 trips in 1 year to the States. And I fell in love with golf over here because it was similar to, you know, what I'd grown up with.
Yeah.
Do you remember some of the fellas that played back then in those tournaments? Any names we'd recognize?
Hal Sutton, John Cook. Let's think, who else was there? Trying to think. There were quite a few guys. None of them really got on to the tour. Dave Navarte, he was the guy who won the U.S. Junior that year. But there were a lot of good Hawaiian players, you know, playing then. there was a guy called Clyde Rigo, who actually was at college at North Texas State with Jimmy Johnson, my old caddy and my old friend. They were roommates. But, you know, I think Gary Hallberg was just coming into the fray then. So I think he might have played in that Orange Bowl.
He was a good player, too.
Yeah, he was a great junior and college player.
Were you able to come over and have a go in any of the other major sort of amateur events in the U.S.?
No, I didn't. I didn't have enough money, to be honest. I did go to Europe for about 3 months in 75 and traveled with three other guys. And we went on the very lowest budget of tours. But we had four of us sharing rooms and all sorts of things. I mean, you know, anything to get over there. But we had a great time. And I actually, in that time, I managed to get to the quarterfinals of the British Amateur. I was beaten by Mark James, who was then beaten by Vinnie Giles in the final at Hoylake. And then the highlight of my year was to qualify for the British Open at Carnoustie, the one that Tom Watson, where he beat Jack Newton in the playoff. And Simon Hobday and I qualified over at St. Andrews. So here in a space of like 10 days, I've played, you know, arguably one of the greatest golf courses, or certainly the most historic golf course. I played four rounds on that, and then I got to play two practice rounds at the Open, and then two tournament or championship rounds, and I missed the cut. But what an experience that was. Yeah. I mean, just for an 18-year-old, it was something very special.
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, one in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcast. Did I tell you about my albatross?
That Carnoustie is a brute, isn't it? Woo! Man, what a tough golf course.
Carnoustie was too much for me. I think I shot 154 and 152 and missed the cut by about six shots, but I don't know. I didn't, you know, I was in awe. Yeah. In fact, I remember, you know, being on the practice tee, and you'll probably get a kick out of this. But, you know, here I am 18 and I've got all of this crappy equipment. You know, I don't have very nice clubs, but in those days, you know, the caddies used to shag balls. Yeah. There was no range.
Right.
And so I find the spot on the range and my caddy's out there like that. And the next thing, here comes Roberto DiVincenzo.
Oh, boy.
And he starts hitting balls next to me. And then next to him, just next to the other side of me, here comes Trevino.
Oh, boy.
So I called my caddy in.
I'm not hitting any against
them. There is no way I'm going to be hitting balls between these guys. So I just moved my clubs to the back of the range. And, of course, then a whole lot of guys came on. But Dale Hayes was there. I played a practice round with Dale. He was always really good to me, and Simon. So I was lucky. I had good friends on the South African tour.
Let's just touch on at least one other thing from your amateur career, because I noted that you were able to represent Rhodesia in 1976 in the Eisenhower Trophy.
Again, I was in the military then. So I think it was September, maybe somewhere around there, of 76. So I'd been in the military for about 6 months, and one of the selectors phoned me and said, do you think you'll be able to, you know, get some leave? Yeah. And I thought, you know, I don't really want, I said, well, send me a letter, you know, and I'll take it to my boss. And I was in the communications then. And my boss looked at this and he said, well, I'll have to go to someone, you know, a little more superior. And, cause if you guys do really well over there, someone's going to ask, how the hell did he get out of the military for 2 weeks? Because that was the trip. But anyway, they let me go, and we had a great time. In fact, I played with Jim Nalford there. That's where I first got to meet Jim. Another guy, Doug Roxburgh, who was in part of the Canadian team. Didn't really know the U.S. team that well there, but, you know, what an experience again. You know, 19 years old and playing with three of my buddies. We actually did okay. I think we finished like eighth or ninth, which for our country was pretty good.
And we tell this story on occasion. Bruce Devlin played in the inaugural Eisenhower Trophy in 1958.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
This is a good piece of trivia.
Sure did.
Where was it?
At St. Andrews.
Okay.
Bobby Jones was the captain of the U.S. team, and I don't know if you remember, but they gave him the key to the city. It's not called that, but that's basically what it was. And he got out of his wheelchair on the Wednesday night and gave a speech like, it was hard to believe to think that this guy was there and was the captain of the inaugural team for the United States. It was a fabulous week. Like you said, you know, I mean, what an opportunity. That was my first trip out of Australia.
Yeah.
It took me 52 hours to get to Scotland in one of those six-engine super Constellation planes. Man, I want to tell you, that was a tough trip.
And who won, Bruce?
Well, the Australian team won, if you can believe it.
Oh, well
that.
Done.
Yeah, how about that, huh? Yeah, and then of course we got to go to the United States for the second Eisenhower Cup match. It was played at Marriott, and of course Nicklaus made his debut there and slaughtered everybody. But as defending champions, we got to go to the White House. We got invited to go to the White House with the American team and got to meet President Eisenhower. And it was quite a remarkable two years actually to be in both of those. That was fun.
And who was on your team then?
We had a guy by the name of Peter Toogood, Doug Backley, and Bob Stevens from Adelaide.
Okay.
That was the team that won. And then in 60, we had Teddy Ball. I don't know if you ever met Teddy Ball.
Yeah, Ted Ball. I remember
Ted
him.
Ball. Jack Coogan was on the second team. And I'm having trouble with the other one.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, I know.
And the U.S. team in 58, Bruce, Charlie Coe, Billy Joe Patton.
What a team.
Bill Hinman?
Yeah, Bill Hinman.
Or Hinman, I mean.
Yeah, they were a good team. Of course, they were supposed to win easily, but the Aussies sort of shocked them, I think, which was good.
And Nick, I think... when the tournament started, Bruce was 19 years old. That's the age that Bobby Jones was when he played in the U.S. Open. The British Open for the first time at the old course, age 19, 19, 21. But Bruce opened with an 81 and clawed his way back to tie for first in the medalist. So he did okay.
You know, the first time I went to Australia, Bruce, I played down I can't remember, played down the South Australian Open down in Adelaide. I played the Lakes, the Australian. I played so many of the courses, so your great courses in Australia. Obviously, Royal Melbourne, one of my all-time favorites and certainly a top three of all time for me, Kingston Heath.
Oh,
I just absolutely loved that golf course. You know, not as visually striking as Royal Melbourne, but
just the kind of course
you could – great, great golf course. But I was surprised when I went there that you Aussies didn't win the British Open more often because the conditions – and I said this to Baker Finch and Grady and all the guys, my buddies from Australia. I said, I just can't believe you guys don't win the British Open every year because, you know, the conditions, Lynx golf and the courses, especially ones on the sand belt, not only those ones. I mean, Royal Adelaide and a couple of others, the ball run like crazy there, you know. And so anyway, but you guys have had a good success rate in the British Open, I must say.
Oh, you mentioned something there about the sand belt. For our listeners, it might be interesting to say this. You could stay in a little motel about 15 miles southeast of Melbourne and stay there for a month and not drive more than 10 miles and play a championship golf course every day. That's how many good golf courses there are in that Sandbelt area in Melbourne.
Nick, tell us a little bit about the thought process you went through as you contemplating turning professional back in 1977.
Well, you know, I didn't play very well through that military period of mine because I wasn't playing a lot. And, you know, when I came out of the military, about a month before I finished, you know, my dad had died when I was younger, when I was 10. So my mom and I, you know, sort of lived together because my two brothers were older. But we spent a lot of time, you know, talking. She's a great, wise old bird, my mom was. She was a wonderful, wonderful person. And she said to me about a month before I got demobbed, she said, you know, what are you going to do? And I thought, you know, well, I don't know. I mean, I thought about golf, but to be honest, I'm not sure because I'd done those 3 months in Europe on the low budget tours. I didn't really think playing golf for a living was much fun, because of the experiences we had and, you know, catching trains, getting off at the airport, getting on a tube train with your golf clubs and suitcase. Because we didn't have enough money to get rent cars and that, you know.
Yeah.
And I was a bit disillusioned about traveling, I must say. And of course, the weather in Britain wasn't what I was used to either. In fact, I traveled with more sweaters, I think, that first 3 months than I'd owned in my entire life, you know, just playing that 3 months there. But anyway, you know, so my mom said, you got to give it a try. She said, you know, you really have to try. And if it doesn't work out after 2 or 3 years, you know, you can go to college, you know, get a degree and or whatever, get qualified to do something. But you really should try.
Mm.
And so, you know, I mean, I wanted to try, but I guess I needed a little more.
A little push.
Convincing or, yeah, a little bit of a push, which my mom definitely gave me. So, you know, October 77, when I finished, I turned pro about a week later and went down to South Africa and started playing the South African tour.
So you played South Africa. I'm sure you had some success down there. Went to Europe and played the European tour. And then it wasn't until 83 then that you came and played the U.S. tour. Was that pretty much for good then coming over that time?
Yeah, again, I played 4.5 seasons. The 1982 was like a half season for me in Europe. But 78, 79, 80, I got better and better and better. And I think I finished up 12th or 13th on the money list in 80, won the Swiss Open, had a lot of top 10 finishes. And I guess if they'd had a world ranking, you know, I'd won a couple of times in South Africa that year, I might have been in the top 60, maybe top 50 in the world. But they didn't have world rankings in those days. And I was so wanted to come and play in America. Obviously, I'd had the taste of success at the Junior World, but also coming to the Orange Bowl. You know, the weather in Europe was awful. I mean, and a lot of the courses we played were in terrible shape. You know, when we went on the continent, I mean, fairways weren't really fairways, a lot of them. I mean, I'm talking back, you know, late 70s.
Yeah.
You could hit flyers out the fairway. Because they just, you know, they had a short winter and or short summer, short growing season. And I decided after I came to see Ledbetter in the beginning of 82 over here that I was going to try and get my card in America. And so I went through tour school in the fall of 1982. I went through two schools, the first stage, which was actually here, not in Palm Beach. And I got through that and then went to finals at TPC Sawgrass. And we played Sawgrass and the TPC, the stadium course,
mm-hmm.
6 rounds. And that was the first year of the all-exempt tour.
Oh.
So I had my playing privileges in Europe. So I, you know, had a little bit of a buffer.
Right.
If I didn't get my card, I didn't have as much pressure as the other guys who were playing solely to get their cards in America. I had to go, I could go back to Europe. And, but I finished third at tour school. So I got card number 3 and then went back to South Africa and won the money list in South Africa, the Order of Merit, which got me into the US Open, got me into the PGA Championship, got me into all the premier events, the Memorial Tournament, all of the limited field events in my first year. So 1983 came along, and I just, you know, I had, it was perfect year for me to really to build on.
Let me recount Nick's professional record for our listeners. 48 professional wins, including 18 PGA Tour victories, which, by the way, ties him for 46th on the all-time list. 7 wins on the European Tour, 2 wins on the Australasian Tour, and 4 senior PGA Tour wins. Highest world ranking, number 1 in 1994 for 43 weeks. And at least at that point, until recently, I don't know if it's changed at all, but only Tiger Woods has had a better run than that at number 1, which is pretty impressive. Let's have you talk a few things before we get into some of your key wins. We're going to talk about the majors. Talk about your caddy, Squeaky.
Oh, yeah, shame. I miss him so much. He was, I'll go back to 88, 89, around there. He was caddying for a lot of guys. Jeff Sluman caddied for Mahaffey, caddied for Fred Couples. Never really got into one bag, you know, or had one guy he caddied for full time. Mahaffey probably was the guy he caddied for the longest, I think, full time. Anyway, my old caddy, Dave McNeely, was leaving. He was going back to Ireland. So I started looking in 1990. And anyway, I asked Squeak, you know, if he'd caddy for me. And toward the end of 1990. And he said, well, he said, Tom Watson just asked me about 2 weeks ago. I thought, oh, well, I better start looking for someone else, you know. And anyway, next thing, you know, he phones me up and he says, yeah, I'm going to caddy for you. So I said, well, that's great. And so we started at the beginning of 91 together. And the next 6 years, from 91 through 96, I don't know, we just had a friendship. We worked very hard on just getting better. That's all we try to do, was just get better every week, every day, every week, every year. I mean, just to get better, because I had all the ingredients and I was a lot of seconds, a lot of thirds, but I couldn't get over that hurdle and win, you know. And within 3 months of him being on the bag, I won the Byron Nelson. And, you know, we had started, I think, this sort of gelling of two personalities. Just it took off, and the confidence that he gave me, the confidence that I was getting from playing well, you know, the floodgates burst basically, and they, you know, they burst in big time in 93. But 91, 92, I had really good years. I finished 7th on the money list in 91 and 4th on the money list in 92, and then won the money list in 93 and 94. So, you know, that was a great period for me. And Squeak and I used to have these games. You couldn't talk in negatives on the golf course. If you said anything negative, like if you mentioned a hazard, a bunker, or a water, if you said, oh, there's water to the left, fine. If you said it's a 125 to carry the bunker, fine. We'd have 125 to the front edge. So everything that we did was, you know, if there was water left or out of bounds left, he'd always say, plenty of room right.
Yeah.
So we never had a negative connotation in our speech at all.
Very interesting, Nick.
And it was a great thing, you know, and I try and tell a lot of the young guys now, you know, that I play with, I said, it's so important because, you know, that planting the seed, whatever it is, of negativity, is a bad thing. So it helped me an awful lot, and we had a lot of fun doing it. And you know, the highlight for me of our time was the way I won the British Open at Turnberry in 94, because I was always a good front runner, probably because my putting was never my strength. It's hard to come from behind and you know, and win from behind if you're not a great putter. So that's the way I played. I put my nose in front, or I'd be around about the lead. But that day, that British Open, that back nine, I played my tail off, and I made some, you know, obviously the one on 17, yeah. Everyone, a lot of people remember. But yeah. It was an amazing day of putting there.
We'll come back to some of your major successes. The other thing I remember about Squeak is I think it was coming up to the PGA in 91 at Crooked Stick, and your son Greg was about to be born, as I recall. So you withdrew from the tournament to be with your wife, and Squeaks left without anybody to carry for, and who does he end up with?
John Daly. Yeah. It was
freaky.
Well, it was, you know, I don't know if I played with John a couple of times that year. I think even in 1990, we'd had a practice round somewhere, but he played in South Africa. A lot of the guys over there had said, oh, you got to play with this John Daly. He's going to get on the tour. He's amazing. And I actually did play with him a practice round. In fact, funnily enough, it was at the Byron Nelson the first time, but not the one I won. But anyway, cut a long story short, Sue was late. The doc said, you know, don't make any plans this week. So, oh, my God, so this is the PGA. So on a Tuesday morning, Tuesday lunchtime, I withdrew because I felt that I'd have to give someone a chance. In fact, Sue had gone into the doctor. We went in together, I think, on that Tuesday morning. And then coming back, I said, I'm going to withdraw from the PGA because, you know, nothing's going to happen. So, and I got to give a guy a chance to get up there and have a practice round. I mean, you know. And so John Daly phoned me. And he was in those days, we didn't have mobile phones, but he had a phone in his car and one of those, you know, the ones that were attached. And I said to him, where are you phoning me? He says, no, I'm driving. I'm driving up there. So I said, oh, okay. He said, yeah, you know, are you sure you're not going to make it? I said, no, no, I've withdrawn. You know, you're good to go. And I didn't know that he was second, third, fourth, fifth alternate, whatever. Yeah. He just phoned. And so I said, listen, please, do you have a caddy? And he said, no, I don't. I said, look, Squeaks, my caddy was originally from Gary, Indiana, which, you know, is really close to where Crooked Stick was, well, not far away. And I said, Squeaks been up there for 3-4 days just, you know, pouring over this golf course. Because, you know, I was playing really well. I mean, we were playing really well together. And, you know, we'd had some great finish, really good, strong finishes. And so he says, yeah, I'll get him. So, and he knew who Squeaky was. And the rest is history.
Yeah.
And so I'm watching on Sunday him coming down and John Daly's doing this. And I'm thinking, there goes my caddy. I'm done. I'm going to have to look for another one. Anyway, the first thing he did when he phoned me to Squeaky after they won, he said, don't worry, Nick, I'm not leaving you. Because I think everyone had asked him that, you know.
Yeah, probably.
So, yeah. You know, thank goodness.
Yeah, I think for Squeak guiding John Daly around that golf course that week had to be a little different experience than guiding Nick Price around, huh?
He drove the ball, I mean, magnificently that week, and wrong and straight.
You mentioned David Ledbetter earlier, and I was surprised that you hooked up with him as early as you did, and you were with him for a while, weren't you?
Yeah, David and I, we grew up together. He also grew up in Rhodesia at the time. And he was in between, age-wise, between my middle brother, Tim, and I. So David's like 3.5-4 years older than I am. But I played golf with him first when I was about 11.
Okay.
And David was a really good junior golfer. And, you know, in fact, he became a really proficient player. But he could never string 3 rounds, 4 rounds together. That was a problem. He'd shoot 68, 77, 71, or, you know, he'd always throw in a bad round there. And he eventually turned to teaching. And I remember Dennis Watson coming back, who had played his first year here in the U.S. in 81. And he'd started working with David. David had made his way over to the States here. And I said to Dennis, I said, man, your golf swing looks unbelievable. You know, your setup, everything. He said, well, I've been working with David. And I'd had a pretty miserable 81 in Europe. So I phoned David up and he was here in Florida, and I said, I've got to come see you. If you can help me, anyway. So sure enough, as soon as the tour in South Africa finished in February, I made my way over here and spent 6 weeks with David. And to be honest, I know this is going to sound really strange, but I'd never seen my swing in slow motion on video. And, you know, I'd seen it on TV, and I'd seen it, you know, clips of it. And when I first saw it in slow motion, I wanted to throw up because there were so many angles, so many extra moves. And, you know, there I am thinking I'm swinging the club. You know, I knew I had a loop or dropped the club inside, but this was so pronounced. And obviously, because I played poorly in 1981, it was more pronounced. So anyway, David and I started, and he helped me a lot, you know, getting the swing plane right, getting my, you know, I was on a parallel track, understanding what the swing plane was, but I wasn't on track, and he helped me to get on track. And from that day on, the first week I worked with him, I knew that I was going to learn an awful lot, and I was going to make very good progress. And, you know, 3 months after, 4 months after working, starting work with him, I nearly won the British Open at Troon in 1982. And so that was a huge, huge step for me.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle. Quiet.